Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money at
Menards. You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Everyone, welcome to another episode of Archaeo Animals, the podcast all about zooarchaeology. I'm your host, Alex Fitzpatrick, and with me, as always,
Simona Falanga.
And this is the second part of our latest mini-series, which we've titled Where in the World, because I'm extremely good at titles. And it's finally forcing us to not talk about British stuff and actually look at the other parts of the world, because there's a world out there beyond the UK, shockingly.
Once again, like dropping truth bombs within like 2 minutes.
Yeah, I know. And I don't think you'll be able to even talk about the Romans in this episode. So, are you going to be okay?
I don't know. Like, I'm sure I can shove them in somewhere.
This is true. Yes, we know this as a fact now.
But yeah, no, it's quite good because it's giving us a chance to get out of our comfort zone. Because we are very conscious, of course, both of us being trained and living in the UK, we do tend to get a bit British-centric. So, yeah, what we've been doing sort of for this mini-series, that we've broken them up into continents. So we covered Europe in our last one, so feel free to go check it out if you want. And today we'll be looking at Africa. Of course, disclaimer, as for all of our mini-series, you know, these are roughly sort of one-hour-long episodes, so it is a very broad overview of sort of zoo archaeology in any given continent. So please, you know, bear that in mind, because especially, you know, with Africa, it's a huge continent. So we'll do our best with the time we've got.
Yeah, so we will be speaking a bit broadly, but we'll make specifics when and where we can. And this will go for the rest of the mini-series. That said, if you like these episodes and you want us to tackle, say, a specific country or a specific region within these continents, let us know. We love to take episode requests when they come. Anyway, let's start with the wild species, as we have been doing in the last episode. So Africa is great because we can actually get into some really interesting species that we haven't talked about in previous episodes, starting with the African elephant, which technically refers to two separate species, the African bush elephant.
Am I doing the species name again?
Every time.
Loxodonta africana.
It just sounds right when you say it. It's not going to sound right when my American accent tries and tackles this. And also, I did really poorly in Latin when I took it in my undergraduate. So it's a little bit traumatizing for me.
Fair enough. I just make them all sound like Roman generals.
This is true. The other subspecies is the African forest elephant.
Loxodonta ciclotis.
Yeah. There you go. And arguably the most important part of the elephant from a archaeological perspective, if we're just looking at artifactual kind of remains and things like that, is the ivory tusks, which have actually been found as grave goods from burials of important people and leaders of the Igbo Ukwu in Nigeria. And ivory artwork is also commonly associated with the Kingdom of Congo, located in the Lower Congo region of Africa. These also include very elaborately carved side-blown horns called olifants. And these very figurative, again, very elegantly carved scepters. So these are actually really kind of important when we look at the Portuguese colonization of parts of Africa. When Portuguese colonizers and missionaries actually arrived to the continent, many of these kind of ivory artworks would be especially commissioned as gifts and trade, leading them to be referred to by many as the Afro-Portuguese ivories. So many of them are on display under that kind of name.
And also in terms of wild species, because another sort of fairly well-known one is the Western gorilla. But again, like the elephant, where we do refer to two separate species, you have the Western lowland gorilla, 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 just in case there were any doubts there, it's gorilla three times, and the cross river gorilla, 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 dieli. Which in a way, like, we wanted to cover gorillas because it gives us an interesting sort of moment to talk about sort of a distant cousin of zoo archaeology, primatology, which is arguably a branch of physical anthropology. Primatology, of course, specifically studies non-human primates and looks sort of at their interactions between themselves and other species, their behaviours and so on, their evolution over time. These studies, of course, you know, have been crucial to helping us better understand things such as the complexity of gorilla societies and social groups, as well as their ability to use tools and gather food more easily, which is incredibly fascinating to think of from an archaeological perspective.
Yeah, because, you know, we always look at objects, things that look like tools from that kind of anthropocentric perspective, especially obviously places like the United Kingdom where we don't really have gorillas. And, you know, if you find something that looks like it was used as a tool, you'd be like, oh, you know, is that some kind of warped item, some kind of tool used by humans from long past? But it's interesting to think of finding objects. And for gorillas, it's mostly just kind of reworking branches and things like that. But even still, it's interesting to kind of not consider them as tools in that same perspective, even though they technically are.
But it's because it's an object that has been shaped to serve a particular, or not necessarily been reshaped, or an object has been repurposed for a particular use with intent. Because you see that with a range of sort of primates, and you see that in chimpanzees as well, where like tools get utilized for what doesn't look like their apparent purpose, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's just interesting, I guess, to think of if you had, say, a archaeological assemblage, and let's say there were a couple of branches in there that were actually used as tools by gorillas, we wouldn't be able to really know. But it's just funny that would be kind of in an assemblage of items that could be used as tools, and we would just not even consider it because we're very anthropocentric a lot of the times in our work.
Yes, we do forget that, you know, like using tools is not a human specialty. I mean, plenty of other species do. I mean, corvids, I think, have been proven to use tools. Like I said, they'll gather sort of twigs and sticks to like help like extract insects, and they'll like keep them aside, reuse them later.
Yeah, there was a really great tweet a couple of weeks ago. Someone pointed out that there was they found like a bottle and a bunch of like shells, like empty kind of like snail shells. And they pointed out, oh, this has been used as a tool by like local birds that were like smashing the shells against the bottle this whole time. And it's like the little things like that I find very, very interesting, especially from a zooarchaeological perspective of trying to be less anthropocentric. I don't know. I like to tie in my brain in knots sometimes. I think it's fun, I guess. And also, like I said, this was a great example of primatology, which we don't really talk about, but is kind of our distant zooarchaeological cousin in a way.
And I guess, again, because we tend to be very British-centric, that there's not much in the way of primates that isn't human. with the exception, now we know, of the one monkey species in Gibraltar.
This is true. Yes, of course, that's the one exception. But especially, I think, as an American who, you know, in America, archaeology and anthropology are very much intertwined. I did a whole semester in primatology. I realized it was not my thing, which is, I guess, kind of ironic, given that I went on to do zooarchaeology, which isn't really that different in some respects. I was kind of just like, all these monkey bones look the same. I don't get it. And look at me now. guess they had the last laugh.
Make them a great blog post. These Pokemon are all the same. I don't get it.
To be fair, the lecture was also at 9 a.m. on a Wednesday. So, I mean, let's just say I did not show up most of the time. So maybe I missed some of the key classes that taught me how to differentiate between all those bones. I'm a very good student. Anyway, moving on. The other kind of animal I think we all kind of think of when we think of Africa is the lion.
Yes, Panthera leo.
Thank you. I'm just waiting for that. And it's arguably one of the most important animals, both culturally and symbolically, across many African cultures. Lions are pretty well represented in depictions across African artifacts, which, you know, makes sense. There's a lot of cultures kind of symbolize lions as being the top of kind of hierarchies in the animal kingdom, the idea of it, you know, king of the jungle type things, associating it with strength and rulership. Although I also know that in some East African cultures in particular, in East African folklore, the lion is considered a very lazy creature and is often kind of like a bit of the butt of some jokes in terms of being slow and lazy and kind of, you know, not fussed to get up and things like that.
It kind of is.
Well, yeah, that is the funny thing, is that that's much closer to the actual realities of the lion. But it's interesting to see that kind of difference across cultures. And of course, historically, hunting of lions is very long documented, with the reasons for it also varying across cultures. In ancient Egypt, for example, lion hunting was mostly reserved for pharaohs. And among the Maasai in Kenya and Tanzania, lion hunting is actually kind of seen as a rite of passage. And I believe it's still seen as that among the remaining Maasai that are located there. So it's really interesting to see the lion kind of vary across cultures across the African continent.
Another one that we chose in terms of wild animals is the white rhino. Oof, that's a mouthful. Ceratotherium simum. It is the largest extant species of rhino for now, alas. Again, the trend continues, which has two subspecies, the southern white rhino and the rarer northern white rhino, which I think is now sort of functionally extinct.
Yeah, I believe there's only like a handful, if not like very few left in, I believe they're almost all in captivity, maybe.
Yeah, but I guess like not enough to sort of sustain a healthy population.
No, definitely not.
But anyway, I think probably going to see a lot of that like over like sort of all the continents that we're going to cover, in all fairness. So, but yes, so analysis of Iron Age and historical African farming communities in southern Africa has led to an interpretation that rhinos were both symbolically significant, and that's based on sort of artifactual evidence, just clay and gold rhino figurines, but also significant on a domestic context, based on the skeletal remains that were found sort of in settlements or domestic context in general. So we have uncovered sort of horns, hide, meat, you know, which were likely used for food and goods to trade.
Yeah, it is actually really interesting, because I think also as two people who are not connected to the African continent and have a lot more unfamiliarities in comparison to when we tackled Europe, a lot of these are kind of uses of animals that I think neither of us would have maybe thought of immediately.
No.
Yeah, and like, so it's interesting. I never would have thought white rhino or rhinoceroses in general to be used for meat per se. And I think that speaks maybe to a kind of broader cultural difference in terms of, you know, a lot of times I think when we think of animals, especially African animals, and again, with the disclaimer that we do not do work on the African continent, I don't know about you, but I always kind of think of African animals in the present tense, because especially if you're thinking about the work that's done here in the UK, a lot of that work is that kind of conservation work, you know, zoos, things like that.
Yeah, you tend to think of them as in now and not sort of what the exploitation of the rhino would have been in the Iron Age.
Yeah, and I think that will go across a lot of the other continents that we aren't necessarily as familiar with, you know, or don't have a familiarity with working with them, in that, you know, because we don't think about them archaeologically, it's interesting to kind of delve into the research that's being done or has been done on a lot of these animals and think about how, you know, how they're fought in the past.
Yeah, because I think like the exception, the only time we would have seen this species would perhaps be in the Roman period.
There you go.
Where animals would get brought over sort of to fighting arenas, which again, more happy things.
Well, I guess this isn't really that happy. It's kind of happy, maybe. But our last species.
Sorry, my sarcasm wasn't properly conveyed.
Well, I mean, yeah. This last species is kind of happy. It's the spotted hyena.
Yes, Crocuta.
And it also kind of fits into what we were just talking about with thinking about these animals in the present tense versus the past, because we actually have evidence of the spotted hyena in the past, in the Pleistocene here in the UK. So I don't think we've actually covered the spotted hyena in general, though, but even though...
I think we must have done, because we have a Pleistocene, sort of Pleistocene species episode. So because we covered sort of the subspecies, if you can call it that, that was found throughout Europe, which is Crocuta spelea, sorry, the cave hyena.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Now it's coming back to me. But even though we did cover that in a European context, that was back in the Pleistocene. But today, and of course, in the past, hyenas were actually a major taphonomic agent in sub-Saharan Africa. As scavengers, they actually produce very distinctive assemblages of skeletal remains with identifiable gnawing and associated droppings. And that's why they're terrifying to me, is how they can really go at a bone and leave these very distinctive kind of skeletal remain assemblages. And I don't want that happening to me, to be honest.
No, like I think they're in equal parts beautiful and terrifying, like the honey badger.
Yes, exactly. But it is interesting to think about how, you know, if you have an assemblage of kind of scattered prey remains, you could easily think of it as, oh, it's the spotted hyena, and how they transform their own kind of assemblages.
Yeah, because they've essentially, long story short, they've got the Carnassials from Doom.
Yeah.
Which basically, I guess, will be like the last premolar, sort of the lower premolar and the upper first molar. Big Carnassials.
And as we kind of think about how scary that is, I think we'll take a break and we'll move on in our next segment onto the domesticates.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Convert your current recessed lighting with energy-saving LED downlights from Fight Electric. They're bright and install easily in just minutes. They also go from regular lighting to nightlight mode with just a simple flip of a switch. Save big on all Fight lighting products now at Menards. Shop our lighting options today in-store and on Menards.com. Save big money
at Welcome back to Archaeo Animals. This episode, we're talking about the zooarchaeology of Africa, and we are on the second segment, so we will be talking about the domesticates that are normally found in this continent.
I mean, there might be some repetition here and there, because as we discussed in our previous episode of the mini-series about Europe, the same sort of common domesticates do tend to spread around the entire globe. But we've tried our best to find some species that are either predominantly found in Africa or were domesticated on the continent.
And we will start with the dromedary.
Camelus dromedarius.
Which is also known as the Arabian camel. It was probably first domesticated about 4,000 years ago in the Arabian Peninsula, but it is now widespread in other places such as the Sahara Desert. And we have actually talked about camels in a previous episode.
Yes, I guess the main physical difference that comes to mind is that the camel will have two humps, while the dromedary will only have one.
Which is, you know, something that I would never have thought about. But again, it's that kind of bias that we will come across in basically every single episode that isn't about Europe, or I guess maybe in my case, I'll be able to kind of remember things from North America. But, you know, it's those little things that you're just like, oh, never would have thought about that. And I think we also kind of see that when it comes to the many, many subspecies of many of these animals.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess the full name of the dromedary would be the Arabian one-humped riding camel.
But that's a mouthful. Yeah. And as I said, we did cover camels. So there's not that much difference in terms of what they are as domesticates. They have a very variety of uses, as we just said, transports, the riding camel for plowing, draft animals, beasts of burden for milking, and for meat and wool, and also sometimes for leather, although it is apparently a terrible form of leather that comes out of a dromedary hide.
Well, I guess it's just one of those things you make the most out of the animals you have at your disposal.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, next one is the zebu, which is Bosthaurus indicus, which is actually a subspecies of the domestic cattle. As you can see, you know, Bosthaurus is the species name of domesticated cattle, with sort of a subspecies being indicus, which makes sense as this subspecies of cattle actually originates from the southeast of Asia and has since spread to the African continent. You can generally find sort of depictions of the zebu on pottery found in Egypt, which suggests that actually the subspecies may have been present there since about 2000 BC, with then sort of further introductions to sub-Saharan Africa taking place around 700 AD and eventually reaching all the way to the Horn of Africa by the year 1000 AD. So in a way, as you expect, you know, the zebu looks very similar to domesticated cattle, but actually they're not as milk-bearing as most of the cattle breeds we know of, unless they get specifically crossbred with other cattle species, sort of with milk production in mind. So they're not heavy milkers, which is a term that Alex taught us in the last episode. Now, another difference with other cattle, or your generic cattle, include a very characteristic hump and droopy ears, as well as, of course, you know, much better tolerance for hotter and drier climates, which makes this particular subspecies more suitable to Africa and Asia.
They also have very big neck folds, which I find extremely cute. They're very adorable looking. If you don't know what a zebu looks like, please Google it. They're very adorable looking. The little hump, they got the little droopy ears. I'm kind of sad we don't have zebu in Europe. We kind of do, probably in zoos or something, but they're just really cute.
I mean, I guess maybe they could just about cope sort of in the Mediterranean area. Because I guess in terms of landscape, you know, it is sort of, in terms of vegetation and climate, it is quite close to sort of the North African countries, but probably not much beyond that.
Yeah, I believe the other thing I read about them is that they're also very resistant to a lot of different parasites. So they seem to really be pretty sturdy cattle. Heavy milkers, not so much. But otherwise, pretty sturdy cattle with droopy ears. Anyway, moving on to a domesticated fowl, we have the guinea fowl. More specifically, we have the helmeted guinea fowl.
Numida meleagris.
which has actually been introduced across the world as a domesticated species, but actually originates from southern Africa. And they're often kept as, you know, free-ranging poultry and are actually apparently much more protein-rich than other domestic fowl, including chicken, and also much richer eggs, apparently.
It's the one upside of keeping guinea fowl as well, because they are loud creatures.
Are they?
Oh, they are so loud. Like, just easily started. And then when they start going, oh, man.
I don't think I've actually seen guinea fowl, so I would not have known. But yeah, that sounds horrible, I guess.
Yeah, no, I think, like, where I'm from, we actually call them, like, pharaoh chickens.
Really?
Which I guess it makes sense. You know, they are very bright. They're fabulous looking birds.
They are, yeah.
Like bright blue and red heads and then just they just scream.
Yeah, I was looking at some pictures, as you do, during my lunch break at work. And one of my coworkers was like, oh, why are you looking at peacocks? And I was like, no, they're guinea fowl.
Like, no, actually, it's a guinea fowl.
Actually, it's a guinea fowl.
And actually, it's a helmeted guinea fowl.
Even more specific. How dare you? But I kind of get why. Depending on what guinea fowl you're looking at, they do kind of have like those really bright colors that you would kind of associate with peacocks. And yeah, they're very interesting looking, but as Simona said, extremely loud. So, you know, if you're thinking of getting a guinea fowl, proceed with caution, I guess. But perhaps more interesting and surprising to me was that the actual origins of domestication in Africa have only kind of recently been examined. And by recently, I mean, this paper only came out last year. Which I guess it was kind of funny because I always kind of knew a guinea fowl as a domesticate fowl. So it's very interesting that they've only kind of recently done the genetic research. So apparently the suggested date for, you know, the actual kind of separation of species on a genetic level is somewhere in between 3500 BC and 900 AD in West Africa, and it was a single event domestication. So, yeah, interesting. It's always changing our knowledge of the past, specifically of domestication, I guess, because we only kind of just have the fancy ADNA kind of work and things like that.
Yeah. Moving on from Galliforms onto one that I guess is probably not going to be as well known is the African giant rat, which actually refers to several species, but the one we'll be looking at specifically is the southern giant pouched rat, so Crichetomys ansorgei.
I could not correct you as we've been through. I'm really deferring to you on these pronunciations for the Latin, but
just not 100% where the accent falls there, but hey ho.
It's fine.
But actually, you know, in many sort of rural areas, giant rats actually represent a fairly significant source of meat and protein. More often than not, they tend to be sort of hunted or like caught, although you do get sort of domesticated giant rats being kept, including and being kept as pets. Also, like recently, have been utilized for sort of like more sort of day-to-day, like modern purposes, such as detecting landmines and tuberculosis. Just remarkable. They detect tuberculosis. Huh.
Yeah, I mean, kind of stemming off what we were just talking about with the guinea fowl in terms of, you know, our understanding of the past is always changing. The past processes like domestication are also continuously still working and changing and kind of transforming even today. And the giant rat thing is actually really interesting, especially because I believe there's a nonprofit that started this whole training African giant rats to detect landmines, which is unfortunately a huge problem in places in Africa. And then they realized that they could also take those rats and have them detect tuberculosis.
Sure, because I definitely read about the landmines, but yeah, tuberculosis. I mean,
I think it's still somewhat kind of recent, but yeah. And I was also thinking the landmine issue must be, you know, obviously it's a horrible issue for any person. But I also assume that it must be something you really have to kind of do as preliminary work if you're going to do archaeological excavation in Africa, in some place in Africa as well. So do they release giant rats to that? Well, I mean, at the end of the day, they are heroes. And I believe that's how they refer to them, as hero rats, which is how they should be referred to, because that's better work than I could ever do in my lifetime, to be completely honest. Like, it would be a big deal if I could detect landmines or tuberculosis. And these rats can do both. So, icons. Yeah, good for you, African giant rat. We salute you here at Archaeo Animals. But yeah, it's always interesting to kind of think about more modern kind of approaches to domestication, but more of just kind of finding new avenues that domestication works through, if that makes sense. But kind of going backwards to a more old school form of domestication.
An old friend
who I believe we talked about in the last episode.
We have indeed.
So, but you know what? Who cares? It's our podcast. We can do whatever we want. It's the donkey. We're doing donkeys again.
Why not? A bit of a Equus Africanus Asinus.
But we have a good reason for doing them again. And that is because they were likely first domesticated in the 4th millennium BC in Northeast Africa, probably stemming from the Nubian subspecies.
So the Equus Africanus Africanus.
And the Somalian.
African twice.
Yes.
And yes, and the Somalian is Equus Africanus Somaliensis.
So those two subspecies of African wild ass. So they were probably the kind of ancestors of the modern day domesticated donkey. And given that they were probably first domesticated in this area, they were likely first used by Nubian pastoral groups as pack animals. And eventually they would become one of the main vehicles for long distance trade in Egypt. And their importance to Egyptian culture, and more specifically to Egyptian royalty, would actually be seen in the kind of interpretations that came from the remains of donkeys that have been found in Abydos, which is an area in Egypt that has several different kind of royal graves. A lot of these tombs aren't actually identified to specific kings. Specifically, the one that I'm talking about has not been identified to a specific king, although it's probably one of the early Egyptian kings, likely around the period of rulers such as Narmer. And yeah, so they found, I believe it was 3 donkeys found in situ, completely, you know, full-bodied donkeys found in their own bespoke grave chamber of a unknown early Egyptian king, in a manner that's actually kind of associated with more high-ranking humans. I believe in other grave chambers associated with this one tomb, they found remains of people who are probably high-ranking officials and kind of close advisors and associates with whoever this Egyptian king was. So, I mean, that's high praise, I think.
Yes, the high praise indeed for the humble donkey.
I mean, they probably deserve it. Donkeys do a lot. They may not detect landmines and tuberculosis, but they're cute.
Yeah, they do a lot of hard work. They're also very stubborn, but so am I. So who am I to judge?
Yeah, big mood, as the youth say. Big old mood. And I guess more importantly, and this is what we'll end this segment on, because we need to talk about this, Simona. We've kind of touched upon in the past, you know, that you can crossbreed donkeys. And turns out that they have crossbreeded Crossbred. I know how to speak. Donkeys and zebras. I almost said zebras, but I am American. And I have to remind myself that sometimes. Donkeys and zebras. And we have to highlight this because they have a variety of names that I need to get out there into the ether. So a male zebra and a female donkey cross are referred to as zonkies, zebroids, zebras. And male donkey and female zebras are known as zebrahinnies and zebrinnies. Yes, it's very exciting news. And they have actually been used as pack animals in Africa. In wars, they have been used to carry arsenal and things like that. And more broadly, kind of used as a bit of a curiosity in places like zoos. But, I mean,
well, they're also part, like, of the other section, you know, beyond whomever it was, or beyond their waterfowl collection. Here's my zebra collection.
It's a zonky collection.
And of course, you know, the whole reason why these species can all interbreed is because a zebra also belongs to the genus Equus, which is also, you know, is the same genus as the donkey and the horse.
And now the zonky. So while you think about zonkies, which is exciting to me, we will take a break and we will come back with our case studies.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Save big money on everything for your next project at Menards. Spring is here, making it the perfect time for outdoor projects. Suncast storage sheds are an excellent solution for protecting outdoor lawn and gardening tools. They're easy to assemble, and the all-weather construction provides water resistance and UV protection. Save big on Suncast storage sheds. View our selection of Suncast products today in-store and on Menards.com.
Save big money at
And we are back with Archaeoanimals. We are talking about the zoo archaeology of Africa in this episode. And as always, everyone's favorite part of the episode, I'm not going to spend too much time on it because this bit is probably getting old. It's the case studies. Bum-ba-da-dum.
That was a sound effect contribution.
But yeah, so we are going to talk about two different sites that are probably very important in African archaeology. Obviously, there are loads of sites in Africa. It's very difficult to pick just two. But I figured the first one that we should talk about is pretty important, arguably one of the most important archaeological and anthropological sites in the entire world. It is Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania. So if you're not familiar with Olduvai Gorge, it is the site where one of the earliest human species, Homo habilis, was originally settled. And they would eventually be followed by Paranthropus boisei, Homo erectus, and finally Homo sapiens. So understandably, Olduvai Gorge is a pretty significant site for understanding human evolution, as well as the development of social and communal behaviors among human species. I think, speaking again as someone who was an anthropology major in America, I think Olduvai Gorge is one of those sites you really tend to talk a lot about. And haven't really had a chance to kind of think back about the site since kind of moving to the UK and doing my stuff there. It's extremely cool. Simona, I don't know if you've ever really kind of covered this before in your studies or...
No, like I've independently read about it because, well, it's very cool.
Yeah, and I guess I can't really speak for the way archaeology is taught on an undergraduate level here in the UK. I don't know if it's really kind of talked about, because like I said, in America, archaeology and anthropology are very much intertwined. So a lot of my early archaeology and anthropology courses, we talked a lot about this site. And like I said, it's for very good reason. It is, like I said, one of the most important anthropological and archaeological sites in the entire world. But we won't be talking about human evolution, not only because I still don't really understand it. There's a lot of species names in physical anthropology that I cannot pronounce and hard for me to remember all of them. And that is why I didn't do very well in my physical anthropology classes. But yeah, let's talk more about the animal remains, which I guess I've never even really thought about, because again, it is such a important human evolution site that when we were doing research for this episode, I was like, oh yeah, there would be animal species represented at this site, huh?
I guess it's just something that doesn't immediately come to mind. Like, for instance, like in a previous episode about Europe, we had Pompeii as one of the case studies. And of course, everyone's heard of Pompeii, but you don't, your mind doesn't necessarily go to, so what animals did they keep at Pompeii?
Yeah, that is true. And it's kind of a shame, I guess. I mean, I think it kind of speaks to that. I guess it's like a bit of an issue in archaeology in terms of, you know, what actually gets press, what gets remembered. It's always a very flashy kind of, you know, and again, a lot of times it is human nature. It's stuff that's related to humans. So say like when we were talking about Pompeii, the thing that people remember are those plaster casts of the bodies left behind. You don't necessarily think of, oh, and of course there were rooster remains in one of the houses, you know? And I guess Olduvai Gorge is the same thing. We think a lot about the humanoid kind of remains that are so important to how we understand and conceptualize human evolution. And no one thinks, hey, I wonder if there were animals there.
So are you saying that humans are being anthropocentric?
I mean, it's a hot take, I know, and no one's ever said this, but as longtime listeners know, I say the things people are afraid to say, and I guess I would say humans might be a bit anthropocentric.
Only ever so slightly.
Just a little bit. But, you know, this is why this podcast exists. We are here to look into the zooarchaeological stuff that people don't know about. Yeah, so there are actually a fair number of species present at Olduvai Gorge. Most of them are kind of mammalian animals, but particularly large ones. So zebras, hippos, rhinos, antelopes, pigs, giraffes, elephants, crocodiles, and other kind of aquatic species, some different fish who we will not think about too much because, as everyone knows, I have a vendetta against fish, and various primate species. And kind of interesting in that group are the antelopes. They are the most represented among large mammal species at this site. And this is actually kind of echoed at contemporary sites across East Africa. And the kind of main important part of the zooarchaeological stuff at Olduvai Gorge is actually, I mean, I guess it is a bit anthropocentric, but it's a major part of a longstanding debate over whether or not the hominids hunted or scavenged these animal remains, which we can examine via taphonomic evidence.
With the answer being probably both.
Yeah, ain't that just the way?
Yeah, because of course butchery marks that were found, you know, they're indicative of defleshing. So, you know, humans did have access to remains before any carnivore scavengers, likely through hunting the animals themselves.
And the element composition of these assemblages at Olduvai Gorge seemed to favor kind of those meat-heavy elements, which could be evidence of, say, you know, transportation of select elements, the ones that did have those meat heavy elements. You're going to want to grab those and go for a nice chow down, you know?
This is like one of the theories that we have in zooarchaeology, sort of like the meat utility index, so because where certain elements would be favored over others based on how much, you know, meat utility each element has. But of course, at the same time, that doesn't necessarily bear in mind, you know, so certain cultural variants, because while a particular element may not be particularly meat bearing, it would be favored by a specific culture over another. I mean, like I guess a modern day example would be that people really like chicken wings, but in terms of meat utility, not that much there, but people love them.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at something so deep into the past, we're looking at early hominids, really don't know what's going on there. Like even at that kind of cultural level, you know, so it really is up in the air for in terms of that kind of evidence for hunting. Now, on the flip side, we do have kind of the evidence for scavenging. So there are carnivore gnaw marks. And I believe Pat Shipman, who's an archaeologist, made the point that it seems like the gnaw marks were likely made prior to the kind of cut marks that are found on these bones. There's also the fact that these assemblages were in places that are very easily accessible to both humans and carnivorous predators. And, you know, we just talked about the hyenas and how, as a taphonomic agent, they would drag animals to, you know, their dens and have that kind of collection of remains there. And the fact that humans and animals could actually, you know, get to these assemblages kind of gives, you know, evidence for the fact that it may be humans coming to these little pits of animals that are half eaten and picking off the rest of them. And there's also the presence of marrow breaking marks that are found on all these animal bones. This is actually pointed out by Lewis Binford, who, of course, loves to talk about marrow breaking marks. It may be more evidence towards scavenging, as if you're scavenging for any kind of meat like this, you're going to want to use as much as possible. And that includes breaking the bone to get to that marrow.
Especially if you're basically breaking into a hyena den.
Yeah.
To scavenge. That's very, very brave.
Yeah, no, exactly. So you kind of, if you're going to risk life or death for that, you might as well get the most out of it.
And of course, going back to sort of taphonomic marks that indicate marrow extraction, by that we mean is sort of a particular way in which the bone is shattered, so like hitted with sort of a percussive kind of element. And so the way it shatters indicates that it was hit to get to the marrow.
Yes.
Of course, it's a lot easier these days because you just tend to saw the bone off and get the marrow that way, but that's too easy.
Yeah, and man, did I really look at Binford's work on marrow breakage and marrow extraction for my PhD. So I have a very good idea of what he's talking about with that. Now, we have evidence for both sides. What's the truth? Well, it may be a mixture of the two. One of the more recent kind of interpretations I've seen put forth is that it could be that the early human species were potentially hunting smaller mammals, but they would scavenge the larger ones that have already been killed by predators. And a lot of this has been kind of interpreted through more experimental archaeology that has been done looking at survivorship of bones and taphonomic frequencies. But at the end of the day, it seems to be something that we may not really kind of get the you know, quote unquote truth from, because it's very much based on timing, because it really is kind of chicken and egg almost, you know?
Yeah. And again, like as with most things, the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle, because like if they were already hunting, you know, like, okay, you hunt your smaller mammals, your antelope, but then you see like an antelope that's literally right there and someone's done all the work for it already. You will take advantage of that.
Yeah, I mean, Simona, what do you think after hearing kind of both sides of the debate?
I think I'm going with both.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's kind of a cop-out, but yeah, I mean, like, you actually make a really good point of you're hunting and gathering for your survivor. You don't really have the choice to kind of pick or choose, per se. If you find something that's already been kind of done, but there's still meat on that bone, you know, you'll probably pick it up.
And also, like, if it's a predator that you can scare off relatively easily, not because by that you're humans are threatening in any way, shape, or form, you know, like just looking at a human, like, oh, it's this thing standing upright, be like, oh, with, you know, no fangs or claws or anything. However, at the same time, like, is it necessarily worth it to pick a fight with this animal and utilize some of my resources and potentially get injured? And it's not necessarily worth it. So some predators might just, you know, go.
Yeah.
And then that's, and then follow me for more like biology.
Moving on, we will look at our second case study, which is the zooarchaeology of Great Zimbabwe. Now, Great Zimbabwe is unsurprisingly located in Zimbabwe.
It's a medieval site.
Yeah.
Which is located in Masvingo in province of Zimbabwe.
Yeah. And it seems really interesting, again, to kind of look at a site that is technically a medieval site because of those kind of biases that are built into not only the both of us who are located in the UK, but also in, I guess, our training as well. And the way we've been brought up in terms of learning about world history, I can say very clearly, I never really got any kind of education on the history of the African continent or even say like the Asian continent, really. So it's very easy to kind of not even think about these different time periods. But yeah, Great Zimbabwe was a very important medieval site. And it was kind of similar to our last episode when we talked about Birka. It was probably a major trade center as well. So there's evidence of long distance trade, including the presence of Chinese and Islamic material goods, and also local trade, as there is a lot of goods from Central Africa. So at its height, it was actually a massive capital of probably a more powerful state, with at least, I believe the population numbers is about 20,000 people at its height settled within its territory, which is huge.
Absolutely, especially for the time period, would have been a very sort of substantial population. Though the site actually originates from sort of earlier Iron Age agricultural communities. So, of course, unsurprisingly, much of the zooarchaeological record that we have found is concerned with domesticates. So you do see sort of certain trends in terms of the species that you observe sort of throughout the time periods. For instance, during the early Iron Age, the most prevalent domesticates was actually sheep. But then as time goes by, you see them sort of being overshadowed by cattle, which then sort of goes on to basically represent the vast majority of sort of the domesticate assemblage among these agricultural communities. Which I think cattle were actually sort of fairly important for people of Great Zimbabwe, as much of their wealth was obtained through the control of cattle herds in the region. So they would, for example, reward gold miners with cattle, thus using the gold as part of their extensive trade network.
Yeah, and there's still kind of debate and research going on looking at the reasons for the eventual decline and abandonment of the site, as they're not really that clear, but it's probably due to the kind of environmental impacts of both this large-scale cattle herd management as well as the kind of immense pressures that you would get from this extremely long-distance trade. Again, you know, going as far as getting Chinese goods, that's pretty massive trade. And it's interesting to kind of think of animals as economically important beyond, per se, the labor and the kind of secondary products that we get from them. You know, in this case, we kind of see how they're a form of currency to kind of support this gigantic trade system. So, I mean, I guess this is the good thing about doing a series like this, where we actually get to kind of see these really interesting, different kind of perspectives and different case studies of places that we would never usually talk about because, you know, we're very comfortable in our British shells, I guess. But I think that does it for this episode. As always, you can find us on Twitter at ArchaeoAnimals. If you have an idea for a future episode for us to cover, if there's something you want us to look more into, you know, just tweet at us, let us know. As always, you can like and subscribe and review us on wherever you get your podcasts. Tell a friend, tell them to follow us. And hey, maybe even join the Archaeology Podcast Network as a member, and you might find some bonus bits and bobs from us.
Thank you for listening.
Yeah, we'll see you next time. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Archaeo Animals. Please subscribe and rate the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. You can find us on Twitter at Archaeo Animals. Also, the views expressed on the podcast are those of ourselves, the hosts and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of our institution, employers and the Archaeology Podcast Network. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Laura Johnson.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Come.